It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. This is our state capitol report. A judge rules against Wisconsin Republicans in a lawsuit dealing with changes made during last year's lame duck session. Governor Evers announces he's pulling the state out of the lawsuit challenging the Affordable Care Act. And the GOP rejects the governor's capital budget proposal. Those issues and more will be what we talk about for the next 25 minutes or so with our state capitol reporter, Laurel White. Do you believe the lame duck sessions violated the Constitution? Are you a member of a union that filed a lawsuit against the lame duck sessions? Maybe you're an employee within the UW system that would benefit from the renovation and repairs of several UW buildings in the governor's capital proposal. Maybe you own a business in Wisconsin. What are your thoughts about giving tax incentives to businesses moving out of state? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR. Mornings. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol Reporter. Good morning.
Good morning, John.
So let's start with the lame duck sessions and the ACA lawsuit. Laurel, thanks to a judge's ruling last week, we've now got a temporary injunction blocking some laws passed during last year's lame duck session. What does this mean?
So basically what it means is that all of the laws passed during that lame duck session are unenforceable right now. So one of those that I'm sure folks have heard about is the law that restricted the governor from withdrawing from that federal lawsuit challenging the Affordable Care Act. Obviously, he's able to do that now because he did last week. There are also a number of other limits that were put on the governor during that lame duck session, things that he wasn't able to do that former Governor Walker was able to do, and also about 80 appointments that Governor Walker made before he left office were struck from the books with that judge's rulings. So we have about 80 vacancies in different state capacities around the state right now.
What was it that led to the judge's decision in this case?
So this was a really procedural argument for this particular case. Essentially, what the plaintiffs were arguing here is that lawmakers never had the ability to call an extraordinary session in the first place. An extraordinary session is when lawmakers say, hey, we want to come into the Capitol and do some work, but we don't have a regularly scheduled session day on the books. So we want to sort of have the power to call ourselves in and do some things. That's what they did for the lame duck session in December. However, that power that they utilized to do that actually isn't in the state constitution. So in this lawsuit, they say, because this isn't a constitutional power that lawmakers exercised to create this extraordinary session, lame duck session, everything should be null and void that they do within this certain parameter of time. And the judge, in this case, Judge Richard Neese from Dane County, agreed with that argument.
Republican legislative leaders, of course, say they plan to appeal the ruling. They say it creates chaos. So walk us through the appeals process. What's this look like?
So Republican lawmakers were very, very quick to come out and say that they wanted to appeal this ruling. That appeal has already been filed. It's with the District 3 Court of Appeals in Wisconsin, which is in the central part of the state. Republican lawmakers actually wanted a very, very quick emergency stay of this Dane County ruling. They said that this is creating so much chaos with these vacant appointments and these laws that are no longer being enforced. They wanted a judge in the appeals court to essentially block the lower court's ruling on the same day. Now, the appeals court didn't agree to do that. They said on Friday that they want to give Governor Evers and Attorney General call actually until 4 p.m. today to file some paperwork with the court to kind of make their argument in defense of the previous decision. And then they'll go ahead and move forward with the appeal.
Laurel White is the Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter and also co-host of the WPR Politics podcast. Laurel, this lawsuit isn't the only one challenging the lame duck session and the laws passed during it. Where do these cases currently stand? What's the other case, and is the other lawsuit affected by the Dane County judge's decision?
So there are four lame duck lawsuits going on right now. There are two in state court. And to answer the last part of the question first, the individual decisions in each of these cases don't really affect the other. These are all kind of going along their paths, kind of parallel paths, not intersecting. Of course, you know, plaintiffs in the different cases will point to the case where there was a decision last week and say, hey, look, see, a judge struck down the lame duck session laws in that case. We're making a different argument. So just sort of symbolically, I suppose they can be related to each other, but practically there isn't much of an effect. The other state lawsuit was brought by a group of unions, and there's actually a hearing in that case this morning. So that'll really get moving this morning, where we hear arguments and see if we'll get a quick decision in that one as well.
Following the judge's ruling, Governor Evers says he intends to pull Wisconsin out of a multi-state lawsuit challenging the Affordable Care Act. This move could not have been a big surprise for state lawmakers.
Mm-hmm. It really wasn't. You know, that was a big thing that the governor campaigned on, removing Wisconsin from this multi-state federal lawsuit. He said that Wisconsin shouldn't be part of a group movement to repeal the Affordable Care Act. He was obviously very supportive of the Affordable Care Act throughout his campaign. So I think this was something that, you know, once the power was returned to him to be able to do that, he moved quickly on it. And I don't think that there was too much surprise among lawmakers. Now, of course, Republican lawmakers weren't pleased, but they weren't particularly shocked, I don't think.
Barring other legal challenges, what does this change mean for Wisconsin?
So actually, you know, dropping out of this lawsuit is kind of a symbolic thing, because it is, of course, a multi-state lawsuit. There are a number of other states that will continue to move forward with this lawsuit, regardless of whether Wisconsin is involved or not. So this is just sort of a statement of where Wisconsin as a state stands on the issue and whether or not they're going to be expending any resources or offering any support to advance this argument.
And what are we hearing from Attorney General Josh Call about this?
So he was very quick to respond to the governor and, you know, took action on, you know, getting all the wheels moving to get Wisconsin out of the lawsuit. So he's very supportive. This is something he campaigned on as well.
So I guess we have to wait for what the appeals court says. Information submitted to the appeals court, and then the court will make a ruling. Ultimately, though, this is going to end up in the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, isn't it, no matter what happens with the appeals court?
Right, exactly. And that'll just kind of follow the chain of appeals all the way and on up to the state Supreme Court. So it's kind of just a matter of time. It seems like this appeal is going to move pretty quickly. Republicans are certainly pushing for a quick decision on this. So we could be at the state Supreme Court with this first lame duck case within just a matter of a few weeks.
All right. We will continue our conversation with Laura White, our state capitol reporter and co-host of the WPR Politics podcast. John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. A lot more to come on our State Capitol Report, so don't go anywhere as our conversation continues. You're listening to the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Laurel White is the Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter and co-host of the WPR Politics podcast. We're talking about the latest Wisconsin political news on the State Capitol Report. Laurel, last week, Republican lawmakers rejected Governor Evers' capital budget proposal, It's said to be larger than any previous capital budget proposed by former Governor Scott Walker. Walk us through the that situation, Laurel.
So this is a pretty large capital budget. It's about $2.5 billion. $2 billion of that is borrowing. To put it in context, the last capital budget from Governor Walker was about $1 billion. So this is really kind of the cornerstone of the argument from Republican lawmakers against this capital budget. They say it's just too much money, too many projects, too much borrowing, that there are certainly parts of the capital budget that they support, but they really think it needs to be pared down so it's a little bit more responsible, a little bit more accountable to Wisconsin taxpayers.
Last week's vote put a long list of UW projects in limbo. UW System President Ray Cross addressed the vote shortly after. What did President Cross have to say?
So President Cross said that he thinks that the UW system still needs to push pretty hard for all of the projects that are included in the capital budget. It's a pretty sizable chunk of the capital budget that goes to the UW system this time around. About $1 billion of the budget is directed for project improvements at the UW system and various campuses. So President Cross, after that vote, said, you know, a number of these projects are very, very important. He said over 60% of UW system buildings are between 45 and 70 years old. And so that creates problems in terms of safety and maintenance, and also the system's ability to attract students, you know, to be a continue to be a competitive educational system.
And there are projects in the governor's proposal that weren't part of the university. What are some of the other projects that are in this budget, and particularly the big ones?
So a set of projects that people, I'm sure, have heard about are the new juvenile prisons across Wisconsin. The budget includes money to build some of those new juvenile facilities as the state closes Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake and moves youth inmates into smaller regional facilities across the state, situating them a little bit closer to their families. There's also money in the budget for a new state office building in Milwaukee, just a whole host of other projects. But I think those are kind of the biggies that people have talked about outside of the UW system, which is certainly taking a lot of oxygen in the debate, as it is $1 billion of the $2.5 billion.
Well, Governor Evers said in a recent statement that some Republicans voted for these projects in committee the day before. So, you know, what was behind the sudden shift?
So this is kind of an interesting procedural happening. Basically, the State Building Commission exists to make recommendations to state lawmakers about whether to advance these projects or not as they work on the state budget. The Building Commission has subcommittees that have to do with kind of the specific parts of the capital budget, so they're divided into categories. These subcommittees decide whether or not the projects are then advanced to the full Building Commission, which then, you know, goes to state lawmakers. So as part of the debate, when Republican lawmakers were voting against each of these proposals, every single one, during the meeting last week, Democratic lawmakers pointed out that every measure passed out of subcommittees with unanimous votes. So they said, you know, a number of all of the Republican lawmakers on the Building Commission had previously voted for the projects in their capacity on the subcommittee. So they said, what's with the change? And Republican lawmakers said, you know, we've talked to all of our colleagues, we've talked with our leadership, and there are certainly projects we support. The things that we voted for, we think are good projects. Some we're particularly invested in and think are good ideas, but we're just so concerned with this capital budget as a whole that we really feel the need to kind of send the message of pumping the brakes, needing to stop and reevaluate and really pare this down before it becomes, actionable.
So lawmakers still have a chance to approve all or parts of the governor's plan?
Absolutely. This vote, it was a lack of a recommendation. What the Building Commission typically does is just send a recommendation on to state lawmakers and say, you know, this looks like a good capital budget to us. We we support these plans. That's just not what happened this time. But the process from here will be the same. State lawmakers on the budget committee will take a look at these projects and evaluate. There's just going to be a little bit more debate and a little bit more uncertainty moving forward in terms of, you know, what projects are going to be trimmed out of this to make it a little bit more palatable to Republican lawmakers.
Laurel White is the Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter and co-host of the WPR Politics podcast. Laurel, with just over a week until the state Supreme Court election, candidates Brian Hagedorn and Lisa Neubauer are voting or are vying for Justice Shirley Abrahamson's seat. What's the latest on that race?
So we are getting pretty close to that that election. Certainly, there's been a lot of debate. We got some kind of an influx of outside money. The National Democratic Redistricting Committee has invested a fair amount of money in Lisa Neubauer, who's the liberal-backed candidate in the race. That's former Attorney General Eric Holder is the head of that group. Some folks might have heard about him, you know, stopping by Wisconsin and making a pitch for Lisa Neubauer. Interestingly, she's kind of pushed back on that and said she's not interested in outside money or outside support in this race. But that's certainly something that her opponent, Brian Hagedorn, has pointed to. I think what this race really boils down to, and it has been very consistent throughout, is each candidate sort of pointing to the other's supposed partisan affiliations or biases, you know, as they move forward, saying, I am going to be someone that's going to be fair and impartial on the bench. That's my judicial philosophy. However, I believe this other person has political affiliations that are too strong, and those are going to influence how they would rule on the state Supreme Court. So that's been a pretty consistent argument in other state Supreme Court races in recent years as well, and we're certainly seeing that play out here too.
Well, technically, this is a nonpartisan election, state Supreme Court justice, but as you point out, our Supreme Court elections have become very political in recent years. So let's talk specifically about this one. What does each party stand to gain if their candidate wins the election?
Well, the partisan balance of the state Supreme Court right now is 4-3, four conservatives to three liberal candidates or justices, rather. So Justice Shirley Abrahamson, who is retiring from the court, she's been a longtime justice, is part of that liberal wing of the court. So if Neubauer, the liberal-backed candidate, wins, essentially the balance of the court will stay the same, 4-3. However, you know, if the conservative-backed candidate, Brian Hagedorn, wins, that shifts the balance of the court a little bit more toward conservatives and makes it much more difficult and much less likely that liberals will be able to take control of the state Supreme Court anytime in the next several years. So this is seen as, while it wouldn't tip the balance of the court right now, a pretty important step for liberals in terms of, you know, are they making that headway toward taking control of the court that they haven't had for a while, or sort of taking a step back.
And finally, a bill just approved last week now moves on to the full assembly. This bill would eliminate tax breaks for businesses that leave Wisconsin. How does this change current law, and what does the state gain?
So under this proposal, which is a bipartisan proposal in the Capitol, businesses that move from Wisconsin to any other state or out of the country would no longer be able to deduct their moving expenses. So storage fees, professional movers, the real estate fees that they pay to sell their headquarters in Wisconsin. Right now, any business that moves within the state or out of state is able to do that. Lawmakers are arguing that that's just not fair to Wisconsin taxpayers to have them subsidize a business that's taking its economic activity outside of Wisconsin. So, as you mentioned, this is passed in assembly committee. It can go before the full assembly at any time. It hasn't had a vote in the state Senate yet, so we'll have to keep an eye on that in terms of how quickly this is going to move forward, if it moves forward.
Well, I mean, who supports this idea? I guess when I first read this story, I went, you know, it kind of made me go, what? You know, we pay people to leave the state. Is there an argument being made that we need to leave the law alone?
As far as I know, there isn't.
There are no organizations, the last time I checked, that have registered opposition to this proposal. It has support from the AFL-CIO. It has support from a coalition of real estate organizations. And as I mentioned before, it's a bipartisan bill. It has Republicans and Democrats signed on sponsoring. So there certainly isn't, as of right now, any opposition to this proposal. It would just be sort of how quickly can it make its way through the logistical process of the Capitol.
Laurel, thanks so much for following that logistical process for us and for coming in and talking about it. I really appreciate your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks, John.
Up next, the news. Then Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller has turned his team's report over to the Attorney General. We break down the political reaction and what we do and do not know about the report so far. That's coming up next, and there's room for you to talk to us about this. 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller's report is complete, but so far we don't know much about what's in it. A four-page summary was issued by Attorney General William Barr over the weekend, but the full report has yet to be released. Here's Democratic Chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Representative Adam Schiff, on CBS's Face the Nation.
I also think the AG needs to make that report publicly available. The special counsel spent 2 years almost investigating this. The public has a right to know and a need to know.
Do you believe the Justice Department should release Mueller's findings to the public, or do you believe the report should be partially shielded? And what would you like to know about that report? What are your initial reactions? 800-642-1234. Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta and a political analyst. Gillespie teaches courses on African-American politics, political participation, and race and elections. Andra, welcome back to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
Special counsel of Robert Mueller has officially handed over his report to the Justice Department. This comes, as Adam Schiff pointed out, after nearly 2 years of investigation looking into whether or not the Trump campaign conspired with Russia to interfere in the 2016 election, along with obstruction of justice. Now that it's here, what's your initial reaction?
Well, I think there's still a lot of questions. I think this is a reflection of the lack of trust that we have for each other in our society, that there are many people who don't want to take Attorney General Barr's sort of word for what's in the report. And I think just given the amount of attention that the, you know, investigation got, there's no way that anybody is going to be satisfied with just a four-page summary of what the findings were. People are going to want to know more about what the details are. And so while the question, I think, is settled on the issue of whether or not there was a conspiracy from the Trump administration directed toward the Russian government, I still think that there are other questions and other details that are worth knowing. So, for instance, you know, what are the details about the ways that Russians tried to infiltrate the 2016 election cycle, and what lessons can we learn from that for future election cycles? That's a really important question to know, even if the Trump administration or the Trump campaign in particular, you know, wasn't actually involved in playing ball with them. Also, you know, were there any types of vulnerabilities in the Trump campaign that could actually be instructive for other campaigns in terms of how they were being targeted by this foreign government? And then there's this question of obstruction. So the first question is that if there's no collusion, then what was being obstructed potentially, since it looks like Mueller actually didn't want to draw a conclusion on it, and what are the details of that? I think it's going to be a really important question going forward. So I think that actually the summary settles a couple of things, but it actually raises many more questions.
In a letter describing the report's major findings, Attorney General Barr noted that Mueller didn't conclude that President Trump committed obstruction of justice, but Mueller also said that he wasn't exonerating the president either. Break that down for us, Andra. What are we to make of that?
Well, I mean, so President Trump has said that he's fully exonerated, and I would say that that line suggests that there's more controversy over it. So, one, I think we need to know more details about sort of, you know, on what dimensions was Mueller not willing to make a consideration. I think what this is pointing to is that there are legal questions, and Mueller was going to answer legal questions, and then there are political questions. And so there may be things that may or may not rise to the level of, you know, criminality from a legal standpoint that might put somebody, you know, in jeopardy of going to jail. But this does actually raise important institutional questions about how is this how we want our government to run. So it's really hard exactly without knowing precisely what, sort of what the details of the sort of unclear if it's obstruction types of issues are at hand. But what this does is that there may be something political that Congress wants to provide oversight for in terms of saying that it's not appropriate for a president to act in this particular manner.
In the past, over the past 2 years, how did we see the scope of Robert Mueller's investigation change?
Well, the scope of it didn't change, and so I think that this is also a really important thing to bring up. Mueller appears to have really followed his mandate and his charge well. So he was looking at Russian interference in the 2016 election and looking at allegations of whether or not the Trump campaign was actually actively involved in this Russian interference, because that, you know, would be earth-shattering and, you know, there would be serious legal consequences for that. So it looks like he hewed to his mandate. So, and he has a different mandate than, say, Ken Starr had, back in the 1990s in the Clinton investigation. So as a result of that, if there was anything else that, you know, was interesting that might be worth investigating, Mueller seems to have been very methodical and very systematic in making sure that he passed that information along to other jurisdictions who might have purview over that. So at least as far as the narrow question that he was tasked with answering, he's responded to that. We await to see whether or not we're going to find out more details of it. And I think the bigger questions of it are, you know, what happens in the Eastern District of Virginia, the Southern District of New York, and in the state of New York in particular? And are there other ways that, you know, Trump affiliates might actually have been vulnerable or have been doing activity that, you know, could be illegal and or unethical?
Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta. She is with us this morning to kind of help parse out what we know and don't know about the Mueller report, which was submitted last Friday. And we have a four-page summary of that released by the Attorney General's office to go by so far. Andra, just because the Mueller report is submitted doesn't mean everything's over. Investigations are continuing, as you point out, in a variety of other jurisdictions. And in the in Congress, especially with Democrats in control of the House of Representatives. So let's talk about that for a moment. Walk us through the range of what lawmakers are paying attention to next.
Well, I mean, I think the first thing is actually getting a hold of as much of the report as possible. So if Attorney General Barr were to just release this four-page letter without releasing other information and doing so in a timely fashion, Democrats in the House in particular would cry foul, and they would actually probably try to subpoena it. So now we would be looking at a court battle that could, in fact, be protracted. I would wait for Attorney General Barr to try to see if he can release as much information as possible. And then there would be the debate on if he redacts a lot of information, you know, is that a legitimate redaction? And so under his guidelines that he has to follow, you don't release stuff that actually has implications for national security, which is reasonable, and you also don't release stuff that has, that is also currently under consideration by a grand jury. There's also the information of whether or not about sort of what is incidental information that could impugn, I guess, the reputations of people who are innocent who just happen to kind of be caught in the report. And so, you know, are there going to be differences in interpretation of what that means in particular? I just think, you know, regardless of where you stand on the issue, whether or not you supported the president or didn't support the president, there's just been too much interest in this investigation for people to not be given details. And I think in the interest of transparency, there has to be some further reporting. There has to be more details to help flesh out what Barr summarized in his letter yesterday. So I think, you know, in the immediate short term, it's a sort of how fast is he going to be able to turn the full report around, having been scrubbed for all the things that need to be scrubbed of it. Will people be satisfied with that? And in particular, will congressional committees, particularly those that have security clearances, be allowed to see the things that are redacted?
Let's take a quick call from Steve in Sun Prairie. And, Steve, we're almost out of time in the segment, so I'll ask you to be brief.
Yeah, this investigation was nothing but the John Doe investigation in Wisconsin. People are innocent until proven guilty. Transparency is great, but you can't ruin people's lives for political reasons. And that's all that's going on here. Let it end. It's over.
Steve, thanks a lot. Did the media make too big a deal about the Mueller investigation and damage people in the process?
So it's hard to say that without knowing the details. So we see this summary. We don't know how long the report is or what the details are that are involved in it. If we have the details, I think we can better answer that question about whether or not the media, went too hard, after folks who were involved in the investigation. I would also say that I think it's really important to keep in mind that the reason why there was an investigation transcends Donald Trump. Right, it's not just Donald Trump, in that there were lots of people who were upset that he was elected president and some who were very happy that he was elected president. There was this larger issue of a foreign government trying to infiltrate our election and going on a disinformation campaign to try to sway people, misrepresenting themselves as they were passing along information, reaching out to members of the campaign to try to actually sort of, infiltrate. And then it becomes a question of, well, why? Why would they try to target the Trump campaign? Was it because they saw this as a novice campaign, so therefore it was vulnerable to infiltration, or were there other reasons? So even if the Trump team didn't take the bait, we all need to know why, because we also want to make sure that that kind of stuff doesn't happen again. So one of the things that I would encourage everybody, in particular Trump supporters, to keep in mind is to think about sort of the process, not just of this investigation, right, because that needed to happen. And we all have to respect the results of the findings, so long as they were done fairly and that they were done thoroughly. But we also have to keep in mind that the bigger question here was about foreign infiltration of American elections, and nobody, regardless of where you stand on the political spectrum, should be okay with what happened 2016.
Andre, I think that's a great place to end our conversation this morning, and I know that we will be covering this issue across all of our platforms on Wisconsin Public Radio as the days go forward, but thanks for helping us out here this morning and giving us a good start. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Andre Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta and a political analyst. Of course, the conversation doesn't stop here on the Ideas Network. You can tune into Central Time after 3:30 this afternoon for continued coverage of this issue. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Want to weigh in on what's officially considered a healthy diet? Well, now's your chance. The 2020-2025 Dietary Guidelines for America are open for public comment. Our guest helps us understand the significance of the dietary guidelines and how they impact individuals' lives and help shape policy. What do you think are the most important things to include in the Dietary Guidelines for Americans? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Beth Olson is an extension specialist and an associate professor of nutrition at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Beth, good morning.
Good morning.
The Dietary Guidelines for Americans are set by the federal government every 5 years or so. Can you explain what these guidelines are and what they're supposed to do?
Yes. These are set every 5 years, as you said, and they are to underlie all policies, programs, educational programs, and the like that come out from the federal government. So this would include things like the school lunch and breakfast program, the WIC program, which helps families with limited incomes for their moms and their children. But it's also used by others. It's used by state and local agencies that provide nutrition education. It's also used by educators and people like myself that work with agencies like Extension.
And the process, what's the process for creating these guidelines? How do they, where do they originate, and how does this work?
So two agencies work together, the U.S. Departments of Agriculture and Health and Human Services, and they convene a committee every 5 years. What was a little different this year, and that's why there was a bit more news about this round, was instead of convening a panel and then having this committee or panel of experts determine what should be updated from the last dietary guidelines, the agencies looked at all their programs and said, what topics, what groups of people do we need to cover in these guidelines? And they came up with a list of questions, which they put out for public comment, and then adapted those or adjusted those as needed after the comments came in. And then based on that, they gathered up the experts they needed to answer all those questions. And those experts will be meeting at the end of this month for the first time, and they'll meet periodically over the next year, year and a half or so, and put together the report, which the agencies will use to issue the final guidelines.
So as you point out, there's been more opportunity for public input for the new guidelines, and so far over, 6,000 comments submitted so far. How, other than helping to shape who is at the table for the discussion, how will these comments impact the new guidelines?
Well, the comments for the committee have already come in, and for the topics. So those are done, but throughout the whole process, there will be public meetings, and the public can still continue to weigh in. And this includes not just people like, you and I who might write in our individual comment. It will include doctors. It will include professional organizations like the American Dietetic Association, the other scientific groups, the American Heart Association, American Academy of Pediatrics. So a lot of experts as groups will come together and say, what is it we need to do for people's health related to nutrition? And they'll put their comments in as well. It'll also involve comments from industry. Industry will say, you want to make this recommendation about changing our food supply, and this is what it would mean to our companies and how we act. And the government does look at that, all of those kind of comments as well, when they make their recommendations of how they're going to do the guidelines.
One interesting thing for me was for the first time, the dietary guidelines will have advice for pregnant women and infants under 2 years old. Why haven't the guidelines included this information in the past, and what made them include it this time around?
Well, I think in the past it has been felt that those groups needed special recommendations, the general recommendations for the healthy Americans over two that we've done in the past wouldn't apply. Those groups often usually have regular checkups. Pregnant women and babies have well baby visits. So they are seen by a doctor who can help them with their diet and also meet a lot of specialized needs that they're going to have. But I think that we are recognizing that health starts very early, and we need a general health advice on nutrition out for everybody. And so we needed to include it this time. Also, we have federal programs, WIC, as I mentioned, that helps limited families with small children. We have the child care feeding program. We have school breakfast and school lunch. We have a lot of programs in which advice is going to go out to families, which include small babies and pregnant women. And so we needed to provide more uniform guidance across those groups as best we can.
Beth Olson is an Extension specialist and an associate professor of nutrition at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're talking about new dietary guidelines which are going to come out from the federal government. Beth, you study how dietary guidelines affect low-income people. Tell us more about that.
Yes. So often I think people read the dietary guidelines and it's about just, they think, nutrition and food, but we have programs, including here at University of Wisconsin-Madison in our Division of Extension, that do a lot of nutrition education as well. And the guidelines inform our nutrition education. We work with families in general in our communities out in our counties, but we also have a couple of large programs that provide nutrition education to low-income families. And this helps those families select the healthiest diets that they can in the context of their local communities, the kind of stores they have, where their children go to school, what they have access to. And it uses other information out of the guidelines around food safety, physical activity, also things like budgeting. What's the best way to spread my food dollars over the course of the month so that I can provide nutritious food for my family for the entire month? And so the guidelines help us develop the messages that are used in that education and also to make sure that that information is uniform across all the programs, so they're not hearing something different in one program or from their doctor or from their school than they're hearing from another nutrition education program.
What's your sense of how the average person on the street, if you will, understands the dietary guidelines? I mean, do people at the granular level, I guess we could say if we're statisticians, how much attention do people really pay to these guidelines?
You know, I think people pay attention to the information that comes out. I don't think they always know where it's coming from. I haven't seen research recently. I was involved in some years ago in which we went out and talked to people about the dietary guidelines, and people understood the messages. They'd heard them. They didn't necessarily understand that they were dietary guidelines or that they came from the federal government. And to that point, we don't really care. We want people to hear messages about nutrition, understand that they're important, hear them from a lot of authoritative sources, sources they respect, and act on them. Whether they understand they're under this larger umbrella of the dietary guidelines or not isn't quite as important. But when we ask people, most people know, you know, I should eat a lot of fruits and vegetables. I should eat whole grains. They've heard the messages.
In our last minute here, in the past, the USDA has been accused of ignoring scientific evidence and bowing to the food industry's influence when they put out the dietary guidelines. For example, cancer researchers and other experts criticized the 2015 to 2020 guidelines for not limiting processed meat intake in spite of evidence linking these things to cancer. Is this a concern?
I think that it's a concern of many groups about what information is used. How strong is that information before we begin to tell people it in the dietary guidelines? How do we communicate which groups are most at risk for certain things versus others? I've known many of the scientists and experts who've been on the dietary guidelines committee, and I think they do an excellent job reviewing all of the research. I think the government it has many influences on it, including its own administration, which has them treading carefully. I think the scientists do a good report. That report's available. We can always watch it. You know, what isn't included in the final dietary guidelines. But I think in general, they do a very good job. The information is excellent. And there's also a lot of information from other sources that people can pull in order to put the dietary guidelines in context and say, what is most important for me and how I eat?
Thank you so much, Beth Olson, for joining us this morning. I really appreciate your time.
You're very welcome.
Beth Olson is an extension specialist and associate professor of nutrition at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Just ahead, Eau Claire County considering an extension on a six-month moratorium on the expansion and creation of large-scale livestock facilities. We'll talk about why that ban was instituted in the first place. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.